Rolling.
This is the FedSoc Films Podcast,
where we continue the conversation sparked on film.
You want to know what freedom tastes like? It tastes like this beer.
Take one.
This is, in fact, the classic solution in search of a problem.
Action.
That cannot help but be controversial.
Cut.
With expert discussion and analysis.
With the greatest legal minds on the topic today. The FedSoc Films Podcast.
It's a wrap.
Welcome to the FedSoc Films Podcast. I'm Samantha Schroeder, Deputy Director of FedSoc Films. This episode is all about our film, The Philosophers Behind the Founders. Who are the philosophers behind the founders? Today we have two professors from the film, Paul Garis and Michael Zugert, who are here to discuss John Locke and Baron de Montesquieu, the tag team philosophers of the American founding.
See, Paul, I once overheard you say that Montesquieu and Locke were the tag team of the American founding, which always struck me as a kind of odd sort of thing to say. What do you have in mind, really?
Well, it is odd because World Federation Wrestling wasn't around at the time of the American founding. But what I had in mind is that the American founders used and thought of these two important philosophers as an essential team, in effect. If you think of the American founding as two major acts, the Revolution and then the making of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, Locke is essential and the most important influential figure for the Revolution and the thinking about the Declaration of Independence. And then a decade later, Montesquieu and another philosopher he influenced, Blackstone, are the most important influences on thinking about a new constitution and a Bill of Rights.
Well, I see what you're getting at. It is a sort of tag team. I'm always amazed at how remarkable it is that how much influence that these thinkers, these men of letters, had on the actual political events of the day. It was a kind of working out of the idea of that intellectual movement they were part of, the Enlightenment, where the idea was that we're gonna have some effect on the world and not just talk about it, but actually have some impact on it. And I think these two guys, they seem to have actually succeeded at that.
They had readers in the North American colonies who thought the way they did, that ideas gave them an opportunity to shape a new political order. And especially for these two philosophers to set new standards for what justice is, what legitimate government is, and Locke giving a broader argument to say we need to be separate and independent from the current sovereign authority of the king and parliament in England, and then Montesquieu giving some more detail about just what the forms of government would be for this new complicated federal republic in America.
It is not, I think, entirely an accident that Locke at least had a kind of actual political impact. In his own life, he actually was very involved in the politics of 17th century England. When he was a relatively young man, he had gotten hooked up with this guy, the Earl of Shaftesbury, who was at one time an important minister in the king's government, but then went into opposition to the king. And Locke was kind of his henchman, right-hand guy who helped him with his politics. Together, they founded the Whig Party, the first major political party in England. And it turned out not to be entirely a good thing for both of them. They both had to flee England at one point, spent several years in Holland in a kind of exile, but partly because of this political connection with Shaftesbury, Locke was involved in really all the tumults of that age, including the so-called Glorious Revolution, which was glorious because it was almost without bloodshed, entirely without bloodshed, but it managed to depose the king, install two new rulers, a king and a queen, King William and Queen Mary, Locke wrote a book, in fact, that was a kind of justification for that revolution, the Two Treatises on Government, which turned out to be the work of great influence on the Americans.
So you said a strange thing yourself. I've heard you say that Locke was so active in politics, he's something like a David Axelrod or Karl Rove figure connected to a prominent political figure behind the scenes daily, working out his philosophy while engaged in trying to shape actual political events.
Absolutely. It's hard to understand or hard to believe how much, on the one hand, Locke was writing, or at least thinking about writing, at the same time that he was extremely active politically with Shaftesbury. What about Montesquieu? What was his political involvement like?
He's easily a couple of generations after Locke, really born around the time that Locke's important philosophical rites are published. The context in France on the continent is different. Montesquieu is an Enlightenment figure, so he believes in liberty and in individual liberty, but not in quite as, let's say, stark or bold a way as Locke does. His approach as a minor nobleman in France is to advocate for reform of existing European governments and even other places in the world to make them more moderate, make them more humane, less despotic and tyrannical and bloody. So he doesn't break as strongly from the dominant political ethos of his day. He's a moderate Enlightenment philosopher. So his political career is not as exciting as Locke's is. He is born into a family that expects him to be a lawyer and then a judge. He inherits the minor noble position of judge in the local court and administrative body in Southwest France in Bordeaux. And then he's so fascinated by the Enlightenment and philosophical engagement that after his first philosophical work, The Persian Letters, is a hit, he keeps his position as a judge for a few more years, and then he resigns from the bench and writes philosophy full time, travels. And that's what gives him exposure to England. He lives in England for almost 2 years. Uh-huh. He lives in England for almost 2 years and is fascinated by close-up study with the English Constitution. And the work he eventually writes, The Spirit of Laws, has these two long studies of English politics. And that's what is the huge influence on the American founders in the 1780s in thinking about, well, what could our form of a new constitutional order be?
Mm. It's interesting, the way you describe Montesquieu, I think there's a good point of contrast, really, to Locke as well, because I think he wrote widely in a wide range of areas, but I think he generally thought himself as an innovator, and I think he rightly thought of himself as an innovator. So the main thing he wrote was a book called The Essay Concerning Human Understanding, which is a book in so-called theory of knowledge or epistemology, as it's called. And in this area, Locke was the innovator, putting forward for the first time the doctrine of empiricism, which is a doctrine that we aren't born with. We have no innate knowledge or inherent knowledge, but we acquire all of our knowledge ultimately through sense impressions. Really a major innovation in epistemology. And at the same time, he wrote innovatory works in political philosophy, his two treatises on government, in one of which he attacks and demolishes, according to the thought of many, the theory of the divine right of kings, and puts forward a new theory that turned out to be very influential on the Americans. And then, really, at the same time, he published a work called The Letter on Toleration, which laid out a relatively new approach to the question of religion and politics, how the state and the church ought to properly relate to each other. So Locke was really a kind of innovative guy, and I think that had a lot to do with the way the Americans reacted to his thinking.
The innovation of the American Revolution, of course, is to make a revolution, a rebellion against a tyrannical government with an explicit statement of a philosophy, a natural rights philosophy, and that does show Locke's influence. The contrast, to some extent, is that a decade later, when the Americans have tried a first constitution, the Articles of Confederation, and consensus is slowly building that there need to be major revisions to that, or even a replacement of it, then a figure like Montesquieu becomes quite handy, and then someone Montesquieu influenced, Blackstone, because I would put Montesquieu's innovation this way, that a very comprehensive political science is needed to understand that radical innovations might not be the best way to make politics more humane and more just. It might be that you need a very careful understanding of a particular place its history, its culture, its customs, its religion, its laws, and then figure out as a statesman, philosopher, or a statesman, what reforms, what gradual changes, what adaptations might be needed. And that actually eventually deeply shapes the American Revolution and constitutional formation. It's partly in the Americans anyway. You know, you know the scholars who contrast the French Revolution and the American Revolution, right? The American Revolution earlier is not as radical as the French Revolution. It decides, well, we're going to do this very bold thing. First ever time in history, have a revolution or rebellion with a philosophical statement of principles. But they don't completely radically change American political life, American laws, American political culture. And then Montesquieu reaffirms that, or Montesquieu's influence a decade later, reaffirms that by saying, okay, we're going to adapt elements of the English constitutional culture in this particular way, meeting our needs and develop roughly on a framework that Montesquieu offers them, some idea of separation of powers and federalism in a constitutional order.
You know, I would describe Locke's relationship to the Americans, or the Americans' use of Locke, maybe better, maybe slightly differently from the way you just did. Because what Locke does is, to some degree, his two treatises for government validate English practice, or at least a certain interpretation of English practice that was already pretty much on the ground. That is, he understands English practice in the way that the Whigs, as opposed to the King and the Tories, the way they tended to understand it. But he provides a new theoretical foundation for it, if that makes sense. That is, he accepts a practice that's already going for the most part, but he gives a certain new interpretation of its foundations. So, for example, in Locke's version of it, there's a clear theoretical grounding in the doctrine of natural rights. That is, Locke affirms that all human beings have natural rights, as Jefferson paraphrased Locke's point in the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal and they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. And that thought of inalienable rights is something that Locke really introduced. The Whig theory of politics didn't really include inalienable rights or natural rights before that. Moreover, Locke insisted, gave a theoretical foundation for why it is that government had to proceed by the consent of the governed rather than by, let's say, the will or whim of the king or any other group for that matter. And that finally there had to be some kind of connection between the ruling parties and the people who were being ruled, a clear emphasis on the necessity for a connection and a, how should we say, that government be understood for the sake of the people and for the sake of the protection of the rights of the people that they have. So second principle then, all legitimate government proceeds by the consent of the governed. And finally, particularly important for the Americans, Locke introduced something that also was an innovation in English thought, although less so in English practice, and that is to say the so-called right of revolution. Locke gave a theoretical case: if government is not doing what it's there to do, as Jefferson puts it, in order to protect rights, if government isn't doing its job protecting rights, then the people have the right, as again Jefferson put it, to alter or to abolish that government. And this is a right that all peoples in all places have when their governments are failing them in that way. So Locke had this interesting combination of a sort of traditional affirmation of a government that was actually existing. He was not, like Rousseau, let's say, inventing a government whole cloth, a different kind of government than the French people were used to. But on the other hand, he did add something. He added a whole new way of thinking about government, which turned out to be extremely influential, not only in America, but all around the world.
And then the Declaration of Independence takes this, Jefferson doing the main drafting, and then, you know, Jefferson and the committee have to persuade the Continental Congress to accept this argument. They take the elements of Locke's philosophy and they put it into an Anglo-American political culture to have some elements of religion, for example, that are not so emphatic in the Second Treatise of Government, right? Invocations of a providential deity in the Declaration of Independence, for example. And mm-hmm. we know that Jefferson talks, you know, toward the end of his life, when he's asked to reflect on the Revolution and the Declaration 50 years earlier, that he was trying to think like an American Whig, or trying to think for a common view among Americans who shared this broad philosophy, so that he was drawing on Locke, but had to fit Locke's thought with some other ideas mm-hmm. in order to make an American argument for this revolution and these.
Yeah, that's a good. I think that's a good observation, Paul. America was an extremely Protestant country at the time of the Revolution, and Locke's thought was less clearly. I wouldn't say didn't have religious dimension to it, but it wasn't so obvious on the surface of it. It wasn't such a big part of it, but it was it was easily able to absorb and to form a kind of link with that Protestant thought that was already on the ground in America. So, what I like to call an amalgam, they created a sort of amalgam between Lockean philosophy and already existing religious Protestant commitments that they had for the most part.
So we have this extraordinary phenomenon in America in the 1770s that practical political leaders in a political crisis refer to, rely upon Enlightenment philosophers, Locke being the most important.
Yep.
And then if we fast forward a bit into the 1780s, the Americans have this extraordinary achievement on the basis of this reliance upon Enlightenment philosophers. They win a revolution. And while the war is being fought, they're writing state constitutions, and they draft a kind of a constitution, the Articles of Confederation. But then by the mid-1780s, there's some sense that Articles of Confederation is not quite working out as well as hoped. And so in a way, the Americans do it again, having had recourse a decade earlier to important Enlightenment philosophers when they're in a difficult practical political situation. They have recourse to Montesquieu mm-hmm. and to some extent Blackstone, his commentaries on the laws of England, influenced by both Locke and Montesquieu. And Montesquieu amazingly becomes the person to refer to in public argument, whether you agree with this new constitution proposed in 1787 or you disagree with it. If you're a Federalist proposing ratification of the Constitution, or you're an anti-Federalist who thinks, no, this is the wrong conception of political liberty and constitutionalism. So talk a bit about that a philosopher comes to the fore again.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things that the Americans were trying to do was to create a wholly new kind of government for the Union. And they had an experience at the state level that was somewhat disappointing, both at the state level and actually at the level of the Union with the Articles of Confederation. And so they had, they were looking for help, authoritative sources for understanding politics. And Montesquieu had by this time become such a thing. One of the interesting things, of course, that we'll see later on is how much Montesquieu became an authority for both the people who supported the Constitution and for people who opposed the Constitution. It seemed as though, and here's the interesting thing, it seemed as though this model of the British Constitution that Montesquieu came up with as a Constitution of Liberty, as the Constitution that captured that very thing that the American founding generation was interested in achieving, that is, a regime that was free and self-governing, Montesquieu seemed to have put forward a model of that, and that was a great attraction to them. Don't you think?
One of the interesting elements of Montesquieu's philosophy is that, unlike Locke's approach, which was this intense focus on a topic, right? Big topics, but a topic. So you were mentioning earlier, Locke writes separate treatises, so to speak, on Religious Liberty, the letter concerning toleration, a treatise on the legitimate form of government, the two treatises, and then especially the second treatise, right? This is the natural condition of human beings, all equal and free. Here's the social contract that's needed. Here's the basic form, a constitution with two separate powers, legislature, executive. And then here's a right of revolution, right? But that's separated from the treatise letter on religious liberty. And so the interesting thing about Montesquieu is that the Americans can have access to a package all in this big book, The Spirit of Laws, which does have some chapters that leap out, obviously the ones on the English Constitution and English political culture and political liberty. But it's in a work that also has this argument about federal republics. You need to make a republic of republics, a federal republic. And then there are arguments about religion and religious liberty and religious toleration, which draw on Locke, have their own sort of flavor, but they're there in this one big almost reference work. And so this is part of why both the critics of the new constitution, the anti-federalists, and the Federalists are able to invoke him, or do invoke him, because there's a package put in front of them.
Yeah, and a pretty big book, a pretty big package it was. Carrying that book around was going to be an achievement.
Americans at that time had tolerance for reading, you mentioned a Protestant culture, right? They had tolerance for reading big, complicated books like the Bible.
Yeah.
You know, and somehow trying to fit it all together.
Well, you know, you mentioned Locke's letter on toleration, and that put me in mind of something I had meant to say earlier. This letter on toleration, where Locke put forward an argument that the state government has no right to impose uniformity of belief or religious practice on anybody, has really nothing to do with prescribing religious belief or practice to people. That's the argument that Locke basically made. And that turned out to be another part of Locke's heritage that was particularly important for the Americans. If we look at some of the important documents of that period, Madison's Memorial and Remonstrance, which was a petition that he had developed in support of it, or actually in opposition to a certain bill that was in the Virginia legislature at the time. If we look at that document, which is a classic of American writing on relation between church and state, or if we look at Jefferson's Bill for Religious Freedom in Virginia, which is another classic of American writing on church and state, or if we look even larger at the First Amendment and its provision for religious freedom. In all of these cases, we see the clear footprints of Locke's thinking on religion, church, and state. So this too, this pretty slim pamphlet that Locke wrote on toleration, the letter on toleration, turned out to be a major influence on American thinking and American practice, really, up until our time. One of the most abiding features, I would say, of American life, one of the most abiding legacies of Locke.
There are some interesting divergences between Locke and Montesquieu, and especially how the Americans sort of interpret them. But this is a real point of agreement between the two, this idea of religious liberty and religious toleration. There are some distinctions, because Montesquieu is trying to write not only for what we would call a republic or a constitutional republic. He's trying to suggest, well, in a monarchy, how can you make a monarchy more moderate, more the politics more humane and less bloody and fearsome? So his general statements about religious liberty are somewhat different from Locke's, because he's thinking across different kinds of government. But the Americans sort of put the two together. And so right in Article 6 of the Constitution is a statement, unlike no government or constitution up to that time, having in a written document to say there will be no religious test to hold office under this government. Now, it's under the federal government, so the state governments could still have some kind of established religion, but that had never been put in a written constitution before. So in a way, it's a convergence of Locke and Montesquieu on this point that emboldens the Americans. And then, as you said, that wasn't good enough. so to speak, especially the anti-federalists, arguing that there had to be a Bill of Rights. Well, there you go. Early in the list of possible rights is the what becomes the First Amendment with these two clauses, free exercise of religion is protected, and non-establishment of religion is a crucial principle.
I think, you know, this idea of a convergence between Locke and Montesquieu, I'd say on the whole, it's more dominant, in my opinion, than not. Because I think there are two particular ways in which Montesquieu builds on Locke or starts with Locke and then, I'd say, goes beyond Locke in some ways. So one has to do with the doctrine of separation of powers, that in his theory of constitution, that is, in his theory of what a proper construction for a government is, Locke develops the theory of separation of powers in a pretty recognizable form, in a form that in modern is very recognizable to moderns. But Montesquieu, I believe, perfects it. That is, it was not really as well developed in Locke's thinking as it was in Montesquieu. So Montesquieu begins with that and extends it. And the second place where I think there's this same kind of relationship between the two thinkers is that Locke develops a theory of what I like to call of the rational political society, what a rational political society or the right political society or the free political society, the political society which aims to protect rights, which aims to protect liberty. Locke develops a theory of what that would be. And I would argue that at least in the main outlines of it, Montesquieu actually accepts that. That has something to do with his acceptance of the British Constitution as a model, because Locke's model is to some degree a rationalized and a theoretically explained version of the British Constitution as well. But Montesquieu raises a question that Locke didn't really raise, and this, I think, produces this very interestingly, somewhat more complicated political science than Locke developed. So Montesquieu sees that this is the rational constitution, but he asks the question, why is the rational constitution so rare? Why is there only one country in the world which we could say possesses the rational constitution? Why is it that in most places we have either despotisms or republics which are less free than this, or monarchies which are less free than this? And so Montesquieu wants to go on and explain why it is that these regimes fall short of the rational regime. And I would say he's interested in saying, how can we move bit by bit, how can we move these regimes more towards the free regime if indeed we can't just reach it right off the bat? Does that seem plausible to you?
Yes, and part of what the Americans do as statesmen who also are reading these Enlightenment philosophers is they take Montesquieu's argument that if you're going to try to have a republic of republics, you're accepting that there's going to be difference in the member republics. Georgia is not going to be different, not going to be the same as Massachusetts. Now, we focus a lot today on the fact that slavery was the huge difference, but there are other ways in which by the mid-1780s, the states were already different, some moving much farther on the question of religious liberty than other states and their republics were. So yes, there is this general convergence with Montesquieu and Locke. Montesquieu's way of phrasing that convergence on the rational, legitimate political order is to use this a big umbrella concept of moderation. The more humane, free form of government could take multiple forms, could be a monarchy, could be a republic, could be some blend, but it will have this spirit of moderation to it in which the worst kinds of threats and fears to human nature and to natural rights will be limited or removed entirely from the politics. And so we'll find the moderate middle ground between possible extremes. Mm-hmm. So Montesquieu phrases it differently, but the Americans sort of put the two together, Locke's aspiration for a more rational and legitimate form of government with Montesquieu's argument for moderation, which still allows some difference or some pluralism in the different models. And so the Americans can say, all right, we're going to have this large republic of republics and accept that there'll be difference across the 13 member republics as well.
Well, if I remember correctly, Montesquieu does say, however, that in this federation, in federations such as the Americans were attempting to form, all the members should be republics. That is, they should be.
Yes.
It doesn't work very well if you have very different kind of regimes in the member states. So the Americans wrote into the Constitution that very provision that the central government should guarantee a republican form of government for all of the member units. And while there are not that many requirements for the shape of new states that would be added to this union, one requirement that was held for all of the new states was that they would be republics, yes, understood as elective regimes of some form.
That's right. That's right. Well, that might be a good point at which to invite people to stay tuned for our subsequent two podcasts, again, on this extraordinary theme that politicians in the 1770s and 1780s are actually reading important and difficult philosophers, and they're taking ideas and directly putting them into important texts, the Declaration of Independence. And here you're just mentioning the Republican Guarantee Clause in Article 4 of the Constitution. Right. This is an extraordinary thing. And so we have two further conversations, one focused on Locke, to talk in greater depth about Locke's influence on America generally from the Declaration and then beyond. And then a separate conversation podcast about Montesquieu's influence on American constitutionalism and federalism and separation of powers.
Thank you, Professor Carice and Professor Zuckert, for joining us today. To continue the conversation on Locke and Montesquieu, subscribe to our new show, the FedSoc Films Podcast, wherever you listen. You can check out our film, The Philosophers Behind the Founders, on YouTube, Facebook, or on our website, fedsoc.org. That's FEDSOC.org. Thanks for listening. As always, the Federalist Society does not take any positions on the issues discussed. That's a wrap.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.